Can you tell us the opening line of Longfellow's Paul Revere poem?
You know, actually, I can't. I have never memorized that poem.
All right. Well, and that's a sign of a slipping American educational system.
It really is, and that's exactly why my book is so needed.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. Today we're talking with Joel Miller, author of The Revolutionary Paul Revere. Joel, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me here.
You note, or on the back cover, he's famous for his ride. He's essential for so much more. What is Paul Revere's significance to contemporary America?
I think there are several elements of his significance. For certain, one of them is his role as an entrepreneur and as a commercial visionary. Starting from the time he was a young man working in his father's silver shop, inheriting his father's silver shop, all the way until his death in 1818, he was involved in commercial endeavors and always seeking to advance himself and his family.
So, is he a version of Ben Franklin, an entrepreneur who's also deeply enmeshed in politics?
Yes, but at a much different level. Mm-hmm. Franklin was an intellectual. Revere was a blue-collar guy who was involved in the political clubs of Boston, but not at the level that someone like Franklin was in Pennsylvania.
Talk a little bit about the ride and, both how that took place and, what's the big myth of the ride? But then also, is Revere the everyman in Revolutionary America? Or
That's, I guess, a string of questions. Yeah. I'll work on them one by one.
Okay.
As far as the myth of the ride, there's a lot of myths around the ride. The reason for that, in part, is that the point at which it became significant in the American story came about so much later after it happened. You know, almost 100 years, in fact, when Longfellow wrote the poem. And so there was an awful lot of encrusted stuff in that story and in that telling, and an awful lot of things that were left out in that telling, and just some flat-out errors. For instance, Revere was not standing in Charlestown waiting to see the two lights,
In the old North Church.
Yeah. Right. He had someone hang those lights, but they weren't for him. He knew for sure what was going on. He was en route to Charlestown to get on a horse and do the ride. So that's one element that's just completely mythic. Mm-hmm. The other, several other historians have talked about this already, but the simple fact that he wasn't, alone. Mm-hmm. There was, of course, William Dawes. There were other writers as well. In fact, the moment the word began getting out, it started going everywhere immediately. Mm-hmm. There's just this sort of disorganized rush to get the word out, and that was definitely something that you don't get out of the old story.
Now, this is not your first book. What drew you to this material to Revere?
The first book I did was about drugs, and the second book I did was about the size of government. And in reality, Revere's story overlaps strangely, pretty much one for one. Smuggling turns out to be a huge story in the founding of our country. Mm-hmm. The tax laws and the regulations, the Navigation Acts, they were called, that governed commerce in the colonies, were flouted by smugglers, and not just ragtag guys, rich gentlemen smuggled,
and including Revere.
The
people that he
in his circle, definitely. He actually did do some smuggling after the Revolution. Mm-hmm. In fact,
against the government he helped create.
Yes, there were tools that he wanted and needed, and there was a law banning trade with England for tools, and so he just had them brought over anyway.
Right. So it's like ordering from Amazon UK or something.
Pretty much. Yeah. So that was one element that I knew a little bit about because as I was studying the drug war, the Fourth Amendment stuff came up, and that obviously leads to the writs of assistance. And as you start studying the writs of assistance, you start finding out about all this smuggling going on. And that story I tried to play up and really give a context for in the Revolution in the book. That really blew my mind. The other thing was just the frustrations faced by the Bostonians in particular. It was felt all up and down the colonies, but the frustration they felt in not having a voice in power that would pay attention to their concerns. And so the encroachments of the government were objected to, but they had no voice in objecting. And so I think I say in the book at one point that they, you know, may have been eloquent, but the, you know, the ears back in London were made out of wood, and no one paid any attention.
Which, you know, now we're in a political season where, you know, there's a movement called the Tea Party movement. People are saying, you know, government is not listening to us. How do you translate what Revere is about, you know, into contemporary America? And what do you do about the violence? I mean, you know, Revere and other colonial revolutionaries were all about, you know, violence in the end. I mean, how does this play out in the contemporary drama?
Well, I'll answer part of the question, and I'll take a dodge on the second part. The first part of the question would be that there is an awful lot of corollaries between people today frustrated with government. And the violence that came out of that time was all about frustration. And you go back in English history, you'll find uprising after uprising about taxes and so on. Right. So what happened in the American Revolution was not rare. In fact, it was something that was a repeatable deal in the history of England. So it wasn't at some level a surprise at all that it ended up happening. The frustrating thing for us today is we've been at peace for so long, when people start yelling at each other, people get scared and people get, you know, worried and so on. Obviously, no one wants to see the violence on the level that happened in the days of Revere, where I mean, full riots happened and down streets and homes were torn down and things like that. But the frustration is real, and I think that behooves people to pay attention to frustrated people, especially when they have reasonable grievances.
Right. Talk a bit about Nelson, Thomas Nelson Publishers, who you work with and who published this book, and also their current imprint. What is Thomas Nelson, and how does current fit into their work?
Well, Thomas Nelson is a publisher that's been around since 1798. It was started by Thomas Nelson back in Scotland, and he basically decided that he wanted to figure out ways of making classics affordable for people. And so he figured out ways of reducing costs and printing and so on. In fact, he developed a printing press that was able to increase efficiencies and printing dramatically.
And this was at a time when a book could cost somebody's year's wages, right?
Or something like that. I mean, books were very expensive. Right. So these were like books for the common man kind of thing. Through, you know, ups and downs and so on for years and years, the company existed, and at some point in the 1960s was purchased by an American immigrant named Sam Moore, at least the American interest in the business. And that's the Thomas Nelson that I work for, based in Nashville, Tennessee. Conservative, probably, for the most part, in its outlook. And so it was natural at some point to start an imprint that would focus on political books. Nelson is mostly known for religious titles and Bible publishing. But we've done books, Bill Bennett's history books we've done, and Judge Napolitano's new book. In fact, all his books we've done. So it fits in at Nelson in that we're concerned about justice and concerned about the encroachments of the state, and we're also concerned about telling good stories. And so,
do you find, from a publishing point of view, is this a, you know, book publishing is one of those industries that's always in kind of perennial decline, it seems. But
the longest dying industry.
You know, next, and even longer than Broadway, right?
Yeah,
Do you feel empowered by, you know, whether it's Amazon or the internet or distribution channels? I mean, is this a good time to be from an alternative power center, not to be in New York or D.C. or L.A. or something like that, to be in a place like Nashville?
Nashville is an interesting cultural place, and I think there are a lot of strengths to that. So I would say yes. I also think that the digital publishing creates a tremendous number of opportunities. Obviously, like any time of upheaval, the trick is to stay on the part that's not fallen down. You know, we're constantly experimenting with things to try to do that. But I think it's a pretty fun time to be in publishing.
Yeah. Can you tell us the opening line of Longfellow's Paul Revere poem?
You know, actually, I can't. I have never memorized that poem.
All right. Well, and that's a sign of a slipping American educational system.
It really is, and that's exactly why my book is so needed.
Well, I want to thank you, Joel, for talking to us.
Yeah.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie. We've been talking with Joel Miller, author of The Revolutionary Paul Revere.